It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Together with Wayne Moyer, the Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Scott Peters is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, professor and department head at the University of Northern Iowa's Department of Political Science. Scott, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
And good to have our listeners with us. Join us anytime during the hour. We'll be flying through about a half dozen developments on the political landscape, as we like to do on Politics Wednesdays. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. For instance, a little bit later in the hour, we'll get our analysts' reaction to the Bob Woodward book and the anonymous New York Times op-ed that has caused so many ripples. Ask you if it's changed your perception of this White House, of this president. 1-866-780-9100. We're going to start off with you, Scott. You have an expertise in the courts of this land, and the confirmation process of the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh has been mostly pushed out of the headlines due to other news. Of course, the hurricane news first and foremost. Catch us up on where we are, Scott, in this process after those hearings last week.
Well, as you just said, hearings were held last week for Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. And those of your listeners who watched any of those, saw any highlights on the internet or on TV, saw a pretty contentious process, a very highly partisan process. The reality of the situation today is that as long as the Republicans stick together, even though they have a very narrow majority in the Senate, Kavanaugh will be the next justice on the Supreme Court, and that looks likely. Senator Grassley, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, is keeping a pretty aggressive schedule, held the hearings, moved the hearings along as quickly as possible. And if I'm correct, I think the current plan is to try to have a vote on the Senate floor in time for Kavanaugh to take the bench before the Supreme Court opens its term on the first Monday of October.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about the hearings last week. Let's hear a little bit of that. Of course, Roe v. Wade really at the center of these confirmation hearings in many ways. During the confirmation hearing last week, the California Senator Kamala Harris pushed Brett Kavanaugh to directly answer a question regarding the precedent set by Roe v. Wade. Let's listen to that exchange.
When referring to cases as settled law, you have described them as precedent and, quote, precedent on precedent. You've mentioned that a number of times today and during the course of the hearing. As a factual matter, can five Supreme Court justices overturn any precedent at any time if a case comes before them on that issue?
You start with the system of precedent that's rooted in the Constitution.
I know, but just as a factual matter, five justices, if in agreement, can overturn any precedent. Wouldn't you agree?
Senator, there's a reason why the Supreme Court doesn't do that.
But do you agree that it can do that?
Well, it has overruled precedent at various times in our history, the most prominent example being Brown versus Board of Education, the Erie case, which overruled Swift versus Tyson.
There are times. So we both agree. We both agree the court has done it and can do it.
There are times, but there's a series of conditions, important conditions, that if faithfully applied make it rare. And the system of precedents rooted in the Constitution, it's not a matter of policy to be discarded at whim.
But there's nothing you and I agree that prevents the court from doing it, meaning that it is not prohibited. Court is not prohibited from overruling or overturning precedent.
Okay, Scott Peters, what do you hear going on in that exchange between the Democratic Senator Kamala Harris and Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee?
As you noted, Roe v. Wade and its follow-up case that really sort of governs abortion law today, Planned Parenthood versus Casey from 1992, those cases were at the center of these hearings. The president promised that he would appoint justices to the bench who would overturn Roe v. Wade. I think Democrats are taking him at his word on that. But of course, nominees will very rarely indicate how they would vote on a given case.
Mm-hmm.
They will say, as Judge Kavanaugh did during the hearings, that it's not appropriate to talk about how he would rule on a particular case that might come before. And so senators are left to try to sort of pick at the margins without directly asking, because they're not going to get an answer to the direct question, would you overturn Planned Parenthood versus Casey?
So that's what we heard there, picking at the margins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're trying, what Harris was trying to get at was the sort of trying to expose the idea that of course the court could, despite the fact that Judge Kavanaugh said it's settled law, it's good precedent. The court could still overturn it if five justices agree.
Mm-hmm. Which is the absolute truth.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And has been done before. You said, you know, the outcome is pretty much clear here. Nevertheless, there is resistance of those who are liberal critics, also grassroots campaigns, to derail Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Take this, for instance. This is in the swing state. We have a couple of, I guess the Democrats have the hope of a couple of senators, Collins from Maine, Murkowski from Alaska. Maybe you can name others. But here is an ad that the Planned Parenthood Action Fund has produced for Maine voters, discouraging Collins from supporting Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court confirmation. Here, the video starts with a screen reading, Senator Collins asked to hear from Mainers about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Here's what they had to say.
Susan Collins has made a name for herself. She has been bipartisan. If she really, really believes in women's rights and what she's saying, then she needs to stand up.
She's got that opportunity right. To be a leader.
If he overturns Roe v. Wade, that goes against what we're trying to do with healthcare, which is give it to everyone.
I feel like I'm desperate for someone to stand up. You represent the state of Maine and all the women in it, and if he cannot commit to keeping Roe versus Wade as is, he should not have your vote.
So, Scott, how should we interpret these efforts as a last sort of Hail Mary to derail Kavanaugh?
I think so. A lot of the focus is on Susan Collins from Maine and Senator Murkowski from Alaska, precisely because they are generally pro-choice. And in today's polarized politics, it's fair to find pro-choice Republicans, just as it's rare to find pro-life Democrats anymore. And so the hope was that they might be able to convince those two Republican senators not to support Judge Kavanaugh. Fairly early on, though, Senator Collins, after meeting privately with Judge Kavanaugh, indicated that he had said in their meeting that Roe and Casey were settled law, and that was a good enough assurance for her. And so I certainly haven't seen any signs, anything I've read that indicates that any Republicans would defect from mm-hmm. voting for Judge Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it the case that elected officials in the Senate, in this case, want to demonstrate to their constituents that they put up a good fight, if I can just put it that way, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, they do. I think we see that more so on the right now. We see that on the Democratic side, right? So the very tough questioning that we saw from Democrats of the nominee, a lot of that is trying to show that they are asking the questions. You know, they're trying to trip the nominee up. They're looking for different types of scandal or controversy. So there were the questions about whether he may have perjured himself in his previous testimony when he was appointed to the Court of Appeals about whether he had received a stolen political document. There were questions from Senator Harris about whether he had made comments to anybody about the ongoing Mueller investigation. So those are, I think, maybe fall into the category of Hail Mary passes of trying to in some way find something that will stick that could convince enough Republicans to vote against him or would otherwise undermine his candidacy.
If you just joined us, political scientist Scott Peters with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Let's move on to what's been dominating the news for over a week, even though Fear, the new book by Bob Woodward, the 17th or 18th book, I believe, officially published only yesterday. We've certainly been hearing about it for many days before, of course, certain publications getting their hands on the book much before yesterday's publication date. Number one selling on Amazon, selling out in many other places. Wayne Moyer, let me ask you, if you have a copy of the book, or have you seen accounts of some of the highlights of the book, what do you find to be most interesting, most consequential in this book?
Yeah, I just got a copy yesterday. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. What is most significant, I think, is the book sort of reaffirms a lot of things that have come out previously in articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post about the disorganization of the White House, the shifts in mood of the president, the efforts of people around the president to control the president, to keep him from doing things that get U.S. policies off the rail. The sense that the policy process is working enormously inefficiently. We had heard about all of this stuff before, but this sort of documents it with specific case studies, specific interviews, specific people. And Woodward has an enormously strong reputation for accuracy in terms of his reporting.
Right, even though this is a deep background is the journalistic term here. We don't name the sources where we got the information, but sort of cross-referenced. And Bob Woodward is very focused on making sure any account, any quote in his book was actually the truth. Is that what makes this different from any other previous books that we've had on this president's inside White House story, if I can put it that way, that he has impeccable journalistic credentials?
Right, he has a reputation that is enormously strong, and he's attacked both, or he's covered both Democrats and Republicans in the past, and hasn't hesitated to critique either side.
Let's listen to Bob Woodward commenting on the New York Times podcast, The Daily. This is from yesterday's episode. Bob Woodward's saying some of the sources have agreed with his claims against the Trump administration in private, but then backtrack them in public. Listen to this. It's an interesting exchange.
After the information and Fear started breaking last week, one key person who's in office called me and said, everyone knows what you've said here is true. It's 1,000% correct. And then this person has said some public things that contradict that. And I'm not happy, but I have a smile on my face because the truth in all of this is going to emerge. There's too much evidence, too many witnesses, and you know this, so you have to smoke them out. You have to do stories to get stories.
So a craftsman sort of as a journalist there, Wayne, this is a man, of course, going back to Watergate, where he became a household name for a generation of us in the 1970s. And I think, Wayne, over a year ago, you were definitely, in my mind, in my memory, the first political analyst on this program to talk about what was happening or seemed to be starting to happen in the Trump administration to Watergate. And we have the connection with Bob Woodward here. Smoke him out. So do you see the same kind of peeling away to get at what is going on?
I do, and it's sort of one thing leading to another, and more dribbles out over time. The other parallels, too, you have to remember that Nixon and the people around him also disputed the stories that Woodward and Bernstein at that stage, who were working together, came out. So they denied the things that he said, but most of them turned out to be true afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Scott Peters, jump in here, whether you have the book yet or not, with your thoughts on Bob Woodward's fear.
No, I have not read the book. You know, a few excerpts here and there and some of the reporting about it. This is usually right around this time in a presidency, Bob Woodward comes out with a book that in a lot of ways is like this, right? He uses mostly background reporting to tell the story of how the White House is working. And on the whole, if you go back over those books he's written, they're usually not overwhelmingly positive views of how the White House is working. But of course, this White House is not like other White Houses, and this book does not look like it's sort of all those other books on steroids in terms of the types of stories we're hearing and the level of chaos within the White House. The big thing that's changed, though, certainly if you want to compare it to the Watergate era, what has changed is partisanship, both among elected officials and the electorate. Increasingly, partisanship is not just something that is policy-driven or ideologically driven. It seems to be increasingly connected to our sense of self. And so what happens in our politics today is that if the people who we don't like start attacking the people we do like, we sort of take that personally. That's an attack on our basic personal identity. And so rather than listen to those attacks, we defend our guy. And so I think one major difference between then and now is then there were Republicans in that case, fellow partisans of the president, President Nixon, who were willing to listen to all of this and willing to take public stances, ultimately. And by comparison, as you heard in that Woodard clip today, there aren't such Republicans.
Mm-hmm. This comes out at a time, or at the same time as the Bob Woodward book, that this anonymous op-ed in the New York Times comes out, also dealing another blow to the president, having to fend off this these claims from the anonymous op-ed, which we've heard much about, telling of a quiet resistance within the Trump administration, a band to, quote, frustrate parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations, as well as to, quote, preserve our democratic institutions while thwarting Mr. Trump's more misguided impulses, that quote from the anonymous op-ed. Well, at a rally in Billings, Montana last Thursday, President Trump bashed the New York Times for publishing this op-ed from an unnamed White House official.
The latest act of resistance is the op-ed published in the failing New York Times by an anonymous, really an anonymous, gutless coward. You just look. He was, nobody knows who the hell he is, or she, although they put he, but probably that's a little disguise. That means it's she. But for the sake of our national security, the New York Times should publish his name at once. I think their reporters should go and investigate who it is. That would actually be a good scoop.
Now, during a press briefing on Monday, the press secretary said,
that would be a good scoop.
Spoke a little bit over the president. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders commented on Monday on whether or not the White House plans to seek out the identity of this anonymous New York Times op-ed writer. This audio has been edited a bit for brevity.
Certainly, if there's an individual, whether or not, since we don't know who they are, if that individual is in meetings where national security is being discussed or other important topics, and they are attempting to undermine the executive branch, that would certainly be problematic and something that the Department of Justice should look into.
Is the White House actively trying to find out who this person is, or do you not really care and you're moving on to other things?
We're certainly focused on things that actually matter. And the staff here that is here to do their job and not undermine the great work that this president and this administration has done. And we're going to continue focusing on that. It's frankly, I think, sad and pathetic that a gutless anonymous source could receive so much attention from the media. And I think that the American people would be much better served if we actually spent some time talking about some of the really important things that are facing our country and the things that this administration is doing to help fix them.
Just a couple minutes before we go to break, Wayne Moyer, have we ever had a time like this when the president's own staff seemed to be acting in some sort of group to undermine his actions?
I don't think so. I mean, if you go back to Nixon and Watergate, most of the staff was supporting the president and, in fact, lying to support the president. This it seems to me is different in the sense that he doesn't. I'm not sure that there's anybody that he can truly trust mm-hmm. in the White House.
Right, Scott Peters. I think the tweet from the president was treason after this came out. Well, what are the implications? Is it some sort of treason? This has been discussed over the last few days. What are the implications for the office of the presidency, for our form of government, when this sort of thing happens? Unless it's the vice president, this is an unelected official countermanding duly elected president's actions and orders.
Yeah. Well, it's worth pointing out, I think, two things. First, it's clearly not treason. The Constitution defines treason, and there's a reason for that. It defines treason because the framers realized that if we look over history, despots use the charge of treason to smear anyone who criticizes the current regime. And so the Constitution specifically says that treason is the act of committing war against the United States or giving aid and comfort to its enemies. Even the Rosenbergs were not charged with treason. They were charged with espionage. So it's not treason. But there is a larger issue here, which is that the Constitution vests all executive power in the President of the United States. Now, the President is in charge of a large bureaucratic organization, and it's hard to get things done, and there have always been ways to resist and slow down presidential orders. But this kind of more active resistance is certainly something I haven't seen before.
Scott Peters is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our political scientist, on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. When we come back, we'll perhaps tie up some loose ends concerning Woodward and the anonymous op-ed, but then also move on to Obama after nearly 20 months. Barack Obama back on the campaign trail for these midterms. Also, we want to hear from Wayne about ISIS, that offensive to clear ISIS from its last remaining territory. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Scott Peters is with us of the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Wayne Moyer, a professor of political science at Grinnell College. And we'd like you to join us with your comments or questions, 1-866-780-9100. Hey, I want to mention this. If you haven't heard yet, renowned journalist and NPR commentator Cokie Roberts will be at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City tonight. It'll be a free presentation. In fact, during the question and answer period, I'll be on stage with Cokie Roberts tonight at 7:30. It's free. I bet it'll fill up. So if you'd like to come, make sure you show up in good time to get a seat. It's presented by Hancher, the University of Iowa College of Law, and the University of Iowa Lecture Committee. And if you can't be there in the audience tonight, you can listen tomorrow to this program for excerpts from Cokie Roberts, giving us her unique perspective on the goings-on in our nation's capital. Today, let's turn our gaze abroad before we talk about more domestic politics. For instance, former President Obama returning to the campaign trail. Before we do that, let's, with you, Wayne, tell us about the significance of this. The U.S. coalition announcing yesterday that the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces have launched a ground offensive to clear ISIS from its last remaining territory in Syria. What does this represent in the fight against the Islamic State?
Well, I think it's an effort to finally take their territory away from them. But I think we need to be cautious because the evidence is that the number of people who are associated with ISIS has not declined greatly. They're spread all around. And so just taking away their last territory, and areas of physical control doesn't mean that they will be stopped as a terrorist group. And so there's an argument there for still keeping U.S. forces in Syria, because if the U.S. leaves, there's a possibility that they could reorganize and begin to try to recreate their state. I think there's another reason, by the way, that the U.S. continues to be in Syria, and that is to somehow or other prevent direct passageway for Iranian aid and forces. Iran is strong in Iraq, and Iran is strong in Lebanon. And one of the things I think with U.S. troops in Syria, it prevents Iran from continuing to supply Hezbollah in Syria, which is in Lebanon, which is a direct threat to Israel.
And perhaps you could remind us, Wayne, of the goals that ISIS set for itself. How many years ago? 4 years ago, when it began its conquests in the Middle East. Is it too much to say they wanted to dominate the world with an Islamic caliphate?
Certainly, there's an ideological component to it, and creating a viable state was one of their ultimate goals.
Mm-hmm. So the message here from you, this news does not mean that ISIS is soon to be extinguished as a threat.
That's correct. And also that the U.S. has other reasons to keep forces there as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to former President Obama. He's returned to the campaign trail last weekend at a California rally, rallying for 7 U.S. House candidates in California. Let's hear a little bit of the former president's speech. Midterms, of course, not far off. That's why the president is hopping back on the campaign trail. He started with his longtime home state of Illinois. Here's an excerpt from that appearance.
It shouldn't be Democratic or Republican to say we don't target certain groups of people based on what they look like or how they pray. We are Americans. We're supposed to stand up to bullies, not follow them. We're supposed to stand up to discrimination. And we're sure as heck supposed to stand up clearly and unequivocally to Nazi sympathizers. How hard can that be, saying that Nazis are bad?
President Obama, former President Obama in Illinois a few days ago. Scott, let me ask you first, the president coming back to campaigning nearly 20 months after he left the White House, committing himself to withdrawing from the daily political debate, as is the tradition of past presidents. What do you see as the impact of the former president entering the campaign arena?
It's a little tricky because on the one hand, what he's going to clearly try to do is to mobilize Democratic voters. And that's probably where he'll be more effective. But the risk that comes with that is that he also mobilizes Republican voters who would otherwise maybe sit out the election. So one of the things that we've seen as party polarization has increased significantly is that sitting presidents are less able to rally the whole public to their cause, because in fact when they go out and speak, they're actually more likely to activate the opinions and attitudes of the other party than they are to bolster their own base. And so it gets very tricky for a sitting president. And you'll notice that Donald Trump isn't even trying to talk to the other side, right? Mm-hmm. He's just going and holding big political rallies that are indistinguishable, completely indistinguishable from his campaign rallies. And so I think the challenge for Obama and for the Democrats here is you want to rally the base without activating the anti-Obama attitudes that in many ways drove support for Trump among Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Let me, before I have let Wayne have a crack at this, let me mention a Pew Research Center poll from back in July said more Americans rank former President Obama higher than any other when asked which president has done best the best job in their lifetimes. Obama was the best, second best president, 44% of Americans in this Pew Research Center survey. 31% ranked him the best president in their lifetimes. Now, President Trump came in fourth in that same poll after Clinton and Reagan. So, I mean, if you're looking for data, and a lot of this doesn't completely translate, I understand completely what you're saying there, Scott Peters, that there is a downside of having a former president there. Would you agree with that, Wayne?
I certainly do, but I would add something else that's coming out now. Even though the politicians are very polarized, there is still strong evidence that there are a lot of swing voters that are left. And there is evidence that Trump's support among swing voters is deteriorating. And I think part of what Obama is probably trying to do is to activate these swing voters to register and actually to come out to vote. And with the deteriorating support for Donald Trump, hopefully that they will vote Democratic.
Mm-hmm. To that point of apathy, the president did speak, I'm not sure if this was in California or Illinois, but a quote from him to that central message that Americans needed to become more involved in electoral politics. Here's the former president's quote. During these times of uncertainty, it is always tempting for politicians for their own gain and people in power to see if they can divide people, scapegoat folks, turn them on each other. The biggest threat to our democracy, as I said yesterday, is not one individual. It is not one super PAC billionaire. It's apathy, President Obama said there. So, Scott Peters, activate those who would not otherwise vote, don't care that much along this thinking of riling up the Trump base.
Oh, for sure, trying to activate those who would not otherwise vote. But for the most part, it's who Obama is going to be most effective with in terms of those who would not otherwise vote are people who already lean in the Democratic direction. Those are the people who are going to positively receive what he's saying. People who would not otherwise vote, who lean more toward the Republican side of things or more towards Trump, toward Trump's message, to the extent that they receive the message from Obama, it's going to be received negatively. And if it does lead them to vote, it's not going to lead them to vote in a way that Obama would find, helpful or beneficial to the country.
Quote from the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the past few days, like a knife. Fight in an alley, a brawl. That's how he describes the close Senate midterm races. Gentlemen, you've been following this. I want to ask you, after we hear from Senator McConnell about this knife fight, how close you think now even the Senate may be. Speaking to reporters in Kentucky, the majority leader, McConnell, commented on the challenging nature of this year's midterm Senate races. Here's a little bit of colorful audio from the majority leader.
And so we know this is going to be a very challenging election on the Senate side. I'll just list you a bunch of races that are dead even. Arizona, Nevada, Tennessee, Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, West Virginia, and Florida. All of them too close to call, and every one of them like a knife fight in an alley. I mean, just a brawl in every one of those places.
Okay. Wayne Moyer, we're seeing a lot of an uptick in the talk about the Senate being somewhat in play, though I seem to see or read it. It's a long shot still. What do you see in the Senate specifically?
I think it is still a long shot. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, it was seen as an absolute certainty that the Republicans would maintain control of the Senate. Clearly, that has changed. I think part of what McConnell's probably trying to do is scare Republicans into contributing more to build up campaign money to actually try to strengthen Republican candidates. But I think it's still interesting that he's very worried about it. It does indicate that there is a changing mood and that the anti-Trump effect is becoming highly significant at all political levels.
Right, 54 days before the midterm, that's the number of days we have. Multiple polls now showing in the last few days that the approval rating of the president dropping by several percentage points. Weigh in on your latest forecast, if you would be so bold with a forecast, Scott Peters, or just your thoughts on the midterm at this point, 54 days ahead of it.
I'm not going to do any forecasting or handicapping, but historically, a president who is this unpopular at this stage, I think the rough ballpark of House seats they would lose is somewhere around 50, historically. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that's a little bit different is typically if a president is this unpopular, the economy is maybe not doing that great. Here we have a very mixed signal economy, right? We have an economy with very low unemployment. And in that sense, that's typically a really good sign for how the economy is performing. But we also have an economy where despite that low unemployment, real wages are not growing. Wages of workers are stagnant. So it's a little unclear how the sort of economic issues how voters might act on those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. When we had a significant midterm back in 2010, Obama, then the president, was it something like 63? It was a huge, a devastating blow to Obama after his first 2 years. 63 seats changing in the House, Scott, something like that. And you're saying this may be on that order, maybe not quite that order.
Yeah, I think this morning I saw a blog post or something from a political scientist who had plugged in the numbers historically, and his model showed about a 50 seat loss. But it's always hard to tell exactly, but somewhere around that range is what people are starting to talk about. I've seen estimates of lower than that. I've seen estimates of a little higher than that, maybe. So it's tough to know for sure. And of course, ultimately, it depends on who votes and who actually turns out to vote, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons 2016 was so close is that the sort of white working class Trump supporters turned out at just a slightly higher rate than people expected them to in a few key states, and that made all the difference.
Well, as Florence, the hurricane, bears down on the East Coast, I wanted to get your thoughts and Wayne's thoughts on how government reactions to disasters, specifically to hurricanes, can have real political consequences. George W. Bush knows this from the blowback, Wayne, he received from his reaction to Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. This was a Category 5 hurricane that struck the Gulf Coast in 2005, killing over 1,200 people. And former president, then President Bush, didn't react well. What lessons did we take away from that, Wayne?
You can get yourself into trouble as president if you don't react well to a hurricane. Now, I think it's especially important for Trump at this stage of the game. His popularity is already declining. There are really serious questions about his managerial ability. This is going to be the big story if a hurricane develops, hits the coast as it's supposed to do. And so it's going to get an awful lot of attention. And if administration doesn't handle it well, Department of Homeland Security does not handle it well, then I think that just adds to everything else, pulling the president down.
Mm-hmm. We had the hurricane hit in a devastating way Puerto Rico, some 3,000 dead there. What are your thoughts, Scott Peters, on the importance of a president to demonstrate at a time of impending natural disaster?
It's very hard to know what the electoral effect will be, but when you look at Puerto Rico, I mean, you mentioned 3,000 people died, which is the current estimate. And it's important to point out, I think, that the vast majority of those people who died, died not directly because of the storm, but because of inadequate response to the storm. This was an absolute failure of government, where thousands of American citizens, you know, a number roughly equivalent to those who died in the Al-Qaeda attacks of 17 years ago, died because the United States government and the Puerto Rican government didn't do their job. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly nobody hopes that, everybody hopes rather that the response is much better this time around. It's almost impossible to imagine that a president that so mismanaged something like that within the American states rather than at an American territory would be continuing on relatively unscathed by it.
Mm-hmm. You're saying then because Puerto Rico is a territory, even though inhabited by American citizens, because it's not one of the 50 U.S. states, that made the difference?
Oh, I think it almost had to have. I think it's impossible to imagine that racial and ethnic attitudes have not played a major role in how people processed that and how people thought about that and possibly and even how serious policymakers took it.
Well, let me add one thing to that I think is very important. There is very, very large new settlement along the southeastern coast of the United States, and a lot of this is retirement homes for people, and many of these people are Republican, and I cannot imagine that if the storm hits as it's supposed to hit, and these people are hurt, that won't have a major political effect.
Wayne, let me go abroad with you for the final minute or two here. The Trump administration says this week it's closing the office of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Washington. Give us some context on this move, because I guess this follows the naming of Jerusalem as the home for our embassy, right? This is another step there.
Yeah, yes, it is. The U.S. historically has tried to take a detached position, more or less neutral, between Israel and the Palestinians. The Trump administration has clearly shifted to strong support for the Netanyahu government. And he's arguing that this is supposed to increase the likelihood of negotiations. I can't imagine how closing their office in Washington increases the likelihood of negotiations. It seems to me what it does is put pressure on the Palestinians to surrender to Israel.
Mm-hmm. And we're withdrawing aid, right?
That is correct. And part of that is Trump is trying to lower the number of people who are declared as Palestinian refugees. He's trying to encourage other countries in the Middle East to accept these people and take away the Palestinians' view of their right to return to Israeli territory.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that strategy will work, Wayne?
I'm very skeptical that it'll work. I doubt very much whether the Palestinians can accept it. It could conceivably increase violence in the area.
Okay, thank you very much. We've come to the end of another Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Scott Peters, the professor and department head at the University of Northern Iowa's Political Science Department. Scott and Wayne, thanks for your time and all of your insights.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
Another reminder that Cokie Roberts will be at Hancher Auditorium giving a free presentation tonight, Wednesday night, September 12th, 7:30. It's free. Show up because it's probably going to be a full house, even though Hancher's quite a big place. No tickets required. Presented by Hancher and the University of Iowa College of Law, the University of Iowa Lecture Committee. If you can't be in the audience, well, listen to excerpts from the Cokie Roberts presentation. I'll be moderating the audience Q&A with Cokie on stage tonight. You can listen for excerpts tomorrow on River to River. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Also help from Shirley Wong. We say goodbye to Shirley. You've been so great, dedicated. We wish you all the best. Shirley Wong, thank you so much. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.